That reminds me of people. I finally got so tired of hearing my book described as a book about a lady astronaut and a cat. I said, yes, it's true, it's about that, and I hope I don't send Herman Melville shrieking from his grave, but I think it's about as much about a lady astronaut and a cat as Moby Dick is a story about going fishing. So.
Yes, also, while it certainly can be in the science fiction genre, I don't look upon it as science fiction.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I never thought of it as science fiction. I never read any science fiction, actually. And when I'd finished the book, one of the few people who read it in the beginning said to me, would you call this science fiction? And I said, gee, I don't think so. And in fact, the traditional science fiction novel, I gather now from science fiction fans, is very often a kind of macho storyline with a lot of wars and that kind of plot development, which you certainly can't.
I think so. So I had some notes here. Just bear with me.
I will.
Do get away with this because...
Right, I understand. I'm delighted to know it's being taped, so all my faux pas can also hit the cutting room floor.
I had some notes here, little things I had jotted down. I wanted to ask you.
Feel free. I'm glad to know that somebody's more disorganized than I am when it comes to pieces of paper.
I had with a young English writer. Very good.
Graham Swift?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've heard he's very good.
He reminds me of...
God, what a reader you are.
Carver.
Oh, really? This is a wonderful packet.
Yeah, it is. Well, I
like
that's
it.
A dust jacket cover.
I like it. I mean to read him. I think I'd like his things a lot.
What's that?
I'd like to read him. I think I'd like his stuff from what I hear.
Yeah. I think you're right. When we're talking about science fiction, about the science fiction, the macho... people and all that. I cut my teeth literarily on science fiction as a teenager in the 1950s. I loved the stuff. My mother used to say, that's all he reads. He only reads science fiction. And I used to collect it, and I would organize my science fiction collection on the shelves of my library in my room, and I'd get back issues of Astounding and Galaxy, which I still have, taking up too much room in a Manhattan closet. And one year I got out one of these cartons of old science fiction magazines going back to 1946 that I collected. And I said, I'll start from the first one and read to
God.
The end. And I couldn't do it. I
couldn't
cannot do it. Read science fiction anymore. For some reason, it is just not the kind of genre that I can deal with now as an adult as I could when I was a teenager. Saying that making it clear that I didn't look upon this as science fiction. Because there are so many fantastic overtones.
Well, there's a lot of fantasy in the book, and there's a lot of science in the book, but I absolutely agree with you, it's not science fiction. You can't have that strong a woman character, and I think that much exploration of really what goes on in a woman's mind and ever wind up in a category called science fiction, at least as it's defined traditionally.
Yes, and your characters are sharply drawn. The one character that he didn't have a big role, but he appears throughout the book, that appeared to me, his name was Rufus.
Oh, Rufus. Oh, well, I love Rufus, too.
Here's a man who's, I think you phrase it in the book, his life stopped. The wind and the stars, how did you say, the wind and the stars stopped when he was 18?
Yes.
And yet there seemed to be all of the potential for him to develop as a writer, an artist, or something, and all of a sudden it vanished. And I just, you know, that struck me, because there are so many people like that. I hadn't seen it phrased like that, that kind of characterization phrased like that, and yet it seems so real.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I think what it was that, you know, he had gone through all this pain in his life. His parents had died, and he'd lost the things close to him. And I think the phrase was something like, because of that, he turned finally his real passion towards the moon and the stars and things 40 million light years away. You know, so far away they could never really be close enough to hurt him. But I'm glad you were sensitive to him, because in the beginning of the book, I think you might think, well, here's this Sheriff Everly, this fat Texas sheriff, and his sidekick Rufus, and these are a couple of dumb cowboys. But I think once you get going, you learn that they're really very intelligent and very smart, and they know that something's definitely going on here that we should be alerted to.
But you do have to characterize the cat in there, too. The The fact that the cat has what I have sometimes when I sit on a long Sunday and start to read the books that I have to read for my series, it's a feeling of narcolepsy, and I'm reading six pages, and all of a sudden, I feel like I felt back when I was in college. Sometimes I said, gee, where's the inquiring mind I'm supposed to have? I'm supposed to be alert and sit there and go through all the material. But I thought the cat was a very, very funny animal.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that.
You don't have a cat like that.
Well, I do have a cat. I mean, he's not like Schrodinger, the cat in the book, but he has similarities. I mean, my cat definitely inspired me, and I'm sure, like, you know, cat lovers are a special breed, and there are people who say to you things like, well, I'm sure my cat gets messages from outer space, too, you know, but my cat does sleep a lot, you know, and I think that that suggested this idea to me about this cat who's asleep all the time.
They all can't sleep. Well, I mean,
this one really sleeps a lot.
They all sleep about 20 hours a day.
Well, they all do. Well, he's right up there on the high scale. But I think if I ever told my husband that I'd taken the cat to the vet, and the reason he sleeps so much is because he has excess electrical activity in the brain, which is what happens to Schrodinger, he'd be mighty suspect. He may be capable of great thoughts, this cat I have. I don't know. I get that feeling sometimes.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about you. Where are you from?
I'm from New Jersey. I grew up in New Jersey.
Whereabouts?
In Westfield, New Jersey. And I went to school in Pennsylvania.
Where?
Chatham College. Very small women's college in Pennsylvania. And then I came to New York, and I just had this...
As what?
It's just a human being loose on the streets of New York, a loose human being on the streets of New York. And I thought I wanted to become a writer. And so I went to an employment agency, which, of course, is an absurd, naive idea.
When did you come to New York?
About 20 years ago, right out of college. And I remember this woman in the employment agency said, oh, you want to be a writer? She said, well, you should go into public relations. And she said, but I don't know, she said, looking at me. She said, we need somebody who can sparkle. Can you sparkle? And I said, well, I'm not sure I can sparkle on command. And I wound up with a job in the publishing industry, and where somebody announced me, oh, we're going to train you to be a writer. We're going to teach you how to write jacket copy. Well, that was hardly my idea at that point of what I wanted to do, but I did go into publishing, and then I wrote my first novel about 8 years after that.
What is a job in the publishing industry?
Well, I started out with the only job I could get, which was a very lofty position, typing labels in the publicity department, typing the labels for all the book reviewers across the United States.
Now, that's don't scoff at that. That's not unlike my job here. Whether or not, we have labels we have to type for our tapes and cartridges, and I spend a good deal of time typing labels.
It was highly skilled. You had to type labels and learn how to put a book in a book bag and staple it closed.
Ah, well, the
for 4 years of college for this.
Probably the stapler would throw me off because I'm not too mechanical. Did you study English?
No, interestingly enough, I didn't. I studied it a little bit, but I wasn't an English major. I was actually a history major.
Were you bookish at all as you grew up?
Oh, yes, yes. I was a great reader, but I had stopped taking English because I had a bad run-in with one college professor. I was very shy in a college classroom. And he had a rule that if you wrote an A exam, you got an A in the course. And he called on me once or twice in the course of the classroom thing, and I could hardly blurt out whatever I was supposed to say. So he was not impressed. So I took the final exam, and he called me into his office, and he said it was a brilliantly written exam. Not only was it brilliant in his opinion, but the stylistic stylistic qualities that it revealed, he said, I couldn't possibly have written it. You know, he accused me of manufacturing this whole thing. So I was so shaken and upset, right? I said, well, I did do it. I did write it. And if you want me to take it again right now, I'll take it. And that was the end of that. But it sort of turned me off.
That's
the English department.
He accused you of plagiarism.
Sure. Sure, he did. So that really, I was so upset.
How did you escape this
accusation? I just said I'll do it again right now. And he said, no. My rule is if you write an A exam, you get an A, so I'm giving you the A. And, I complained to some other professor about it who spoke to him, but the wound was there. So I switched to history. I mean, I just didn't want to be part of the English department.
A writer named T. Gertler has written a wonderful book, which you probably would like because it's about the New York literary establishment, the publishing industry, called Elbowing the Seducer. It's out of paperback now.
Mm-hmm.
And she went to a Jewish school in Miami, The same thing happened to her, where she was accused, she was turning in reports, essays or whatever, and she wrote so well that her teacher said, you could not have done this. And they tried to expel her. Mm. And there was a big controversy. She got her parents involved, and they accused her of having her parents write it or something like that, and they all had to go in and mm-hmm. work it out. But I guess these early sparks of creativity sometimes will throw off people, teachers, professors, who aren't used to it because they see the standard classroom made up primarily adults. I mean, that's, let's face it, college kids are like that a lot, and I don't mean to demean them, but I'm on the national board, alumni board of my own university. I go back there twice a year to board meetings for a week period each year, and so I talk to the professors and I go into the classroom, so I see, and their interest isn't really in academics, nor was mine when I was in college, so I don't really hold that against them. So obviously you did show this spark of creativity when you were in college.
Oh, and I think even as a child I was always writing poetry and short stories, and I just liked doing it. You know, I liked making things up. Mm-hmm. And as I said to a friend of mine the other day, she said, well, are you going to write a book of nonfiction? I've done one book of nonfiction some years ago. And I said, well, gee, I don't know. I said, I really love writing novels. You never have to go to the library. You just make it up. Well, of course, this book has so much science in it. Everybody's, you know, of course, says, but my God, you must have gone to the library. But in fact, I never did research in the ordinary sense of the word. I really started reading subparticle physics because I was just so passionately interested in it. It was just sheer intellectual curiosity. You know, I just loved reading it. And I really did not know I would wind up using it in my novel in quite the way I did. So.
You mean before you wrote The 11 Million Mile High Dancer, you were reading about physics and all of this stuff just because you were amused by it?
Not amused, I would say. I was passionately interested.
Passionately?
Passionately. Absolutely. I could not stop reading this material. And, you know, there I'd be at breakfast reading Einstein's Second Theory of Relativity, and my husband would say, what is it all about? What is this incredible interest? I'd say, I don't know. I really don't know. I just love reading it. It's just like an intellectual adventure. And, you know, there are so many good science writers today who can write for the layman. I mean, I'm certainly not a physicist. And if you had to get into the statistical aspect of it, I couldn't handle it at all. But there are these wonderful science writers around who can make it accessible to you and me and everybody else. I think that was partly the reason I got so interested. Plus, the idea of entering into a realm, the realm of subparticle physics, where all the rules are changed, right? You can't predict events, you can't be logical, you can't be consistent. This was all very agreeable to me because this is pretty much the way I saw the world. So I'm sure that was part of the motivation too.
Well, let's go back to our biographical biography of you a little bit more. You were in the publishing industry. You were typing the labels and stapling the book mm-hmm. and this sort of thing. Then what happened?
Then I decided I really, this character, I have very Pirandello-like experiences with writing. And this character named Francis Jeremiah Scanlon had walked into my head one day and just sat there. And everywhere I went, I heard him talking, and I saw him, and I started taking notes, and he was fat, balding in 39, at the time I was 29. And this novel just began to grow, and so I finally left my job to write, and I wrote the book.
Were you married at this time?
Yes, I was.
So you had some support.
Right. I had that opportunity. And a friend of mine was working at Random House as a secretary, and she said to me, Carol, I'm so excited. I want to read this novel. And I said to her, look, I will show it to you, but with the understanding that you don't show it to anybody else, because I feel this is something very personal, and it's for me, and I don't want anybody to read it. You know, writers are crazy. I was very crazy. So she read it, and she gave it to the editor-in-chief, and she said, this is a friend of mine's novel. And he said, look, I really don't have time to read it. But he was going to the dentist, and she put it into his bag, and fortunately the dentist was very late, like an hour and a half, and he started reading the book. So she called me the next day, and this goes to show you how strange the world of the novelist mind is, I guess. She called me the next day and she said, I have such exciting news, you won't believe it. It's so wonderful. We want to publish your book. Now, people would give their eye teeth to have this said to them, most people. And I just felt this sort of sinking sensation, you know. And I said to her, but I'm not ready to have it published. And I think somewhere there was the feeling that they were going to take it away from me. You know, you live with these characters, they become part of your life. It's no longer an imaginative excursion. But needless to say, reality prevailed, and in about a week, I got used to the idea. But there is still the sense today, when I finished the 11 Million Mile High Dancer, the moment the book is sold, you have a funny feeling. It's like, I guess, children graduating from high school or something. It's a funny feeling. Of course, you write for an audience, so it's contradictory. Of course, you write to get published. You write to be read. But there is that sort of sickening sensation. Who are you, you know, who's in the boat that you're handing the children to, right? Are they going to keep them safe? Definitely part of the feeling.
Well, this business of writing for the drawer, I think a lot of people, including myself, have done that. And certainly people behind the Iron Curtain have to do that.
Oh, wow, that's quite different.
But doesn't it, when you first saw this first book of yours and you were able to hold it in your hands, what kind of feeling was that?
Well, it was quite an exciting feeling. Here it was, finally. It was a thing, you know. And it's a great feeling when you see it as a book. It's really exciting.
The 11 Million Mile High Dancer, this came out of your infatuation with the world of physics.
Well, it came out of a lot of things. I think it came out of my feeling about women and that they think differently and experience differently from men. I mean, I don't think women are superior to men any more than I think men are superior to women. But it came out of my feeling about the universe and what we knew about it. And it came about feeling about science and subparticle physics and all those things kind of, plus my own interest in, I think, the comic form. And these things all just converged. But I don't write in any predictable way myself. I mean, I'm a walking set of subparticle physics explanations. I mean, I just sit down, I never know what's coming. And in fact, I had been 80 pages into this manuscript with mostly these cowboys, Rufus and Everly, and a lot of the things that go on with the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, you know, and a lot of comic development. And then this character of Amanda seemed to just jump out of my typewriter.
Wait a minute. I mean, she came, she was an afterthought?
Well, I was 80 pages into the book before she came. Yeah, and then she came right out of the typewriter, all great, blonde, gorgeous bombshell of herself with this terrific mind. And I said, this story's about you. That's what this is all about. And so I went back and I revised it. And I let her tell me where we were going. And that's the feeling I have when I write.
Now, I can understand. This doesn't seem to be the kind of novel that you can block out in the way that Dick Francis or one of the mystery writers could plot a mystery novel where everything has to be tied up very neatly at the end.
Well, I don't think you could have predicted this. My hope is that it does tie up at the end in some meaningful way, of course. But I can't work that way. If I have an outline of what's coming, I just don't think I want to do it. I mean, I really like the feeling. I like the feeling that you're hearing voices, right? That the typewriter sort of takes on its own presence and you just sort of tap along. And that's the feeling I have with this. So, you know, this crazy character, the primal ooze who winds up in her living room. I thought, I know that feeling. I know that feeling of, you know, feeling vibrations and all that sort of kooky stuff that Amanda goes through. I felt that.
You are still, are you living in Manhattan?
Yes, I live here.
Did you ever have to go back to publishing?
After my first novel was published, I went back into publishing, yes.
Armed with a stapler?
With a stapler?
Did you go back with a stapler?
No, I went back and I became an editor.
Who did you work with?
I worked for William Morrow Company and Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch.
Mm-hmm. But you're not working now.
I found it quite impossible to edit and write. I think they use opposite sides of the brain. And I loved being an editor. I liked working with writers, but it was exhausting, you know, when it was the same as sort of publishing your own book. I mean, you cared very much and you tried very hard. And I decided about 5 years ago that if I was ever going to do any more writing, and I really did want to do that, that I would have to leave the publishing business. And so it had been a long time since I'd written my second novel, but I thought, okay, it's now or never. But I wasn't prepared for the transition at all. you know, because I was used to the business of, oh, you know, you write your letters, you make your phone calls, and that's your day. You know, you edit your manuscripts. And suddenly there I was in this room with this little gray machine and a stack of white paper. And I tell you, it was struck terror in me. And that was a hard transition, you know.
You raised a very interesting question about an editor who is also a writer. Gordon Lish is an editor who is a writer. And he finds it difficult and found that as a working editor, he's no longer a working editor, but he is currently a working editor. But one thing that struck him was that he needed an editor.
Mm-hmm.
He needed someone else to help him. That sometimes mm-hmm. he would get so involved. Have you ever read any of his work?
Yes, I have. Yes.
Dear Mr. Capote, I think, was a novelist. Not
yeah, oh, writer. I think Gordon's a very interesting writer. I like his work a lot.
But here's a man who finds that even editors need help.
Oh, no question. And when you write it, you can't see what you're doing the way that somebody who's not emotionally engaged in this material can see it. You know, because it's so... When a writer is writing, the presence of the world he's in is so real and so palpable. I mean, if you are a writer and you see a blue vase on a table and you start describing the vase, that vase is so clear in your mind, it's quite possible that on the paper it doesn't emerge quite as precisely as it should, or it's not clear that there's a line of action that's happening. I remember on my first novel, I thought an absolutely brilliant copy editor who got so involved in my book called me in and said, you know, in the scene where Francis is sitting down and the doorbell rings? I said, yes. She said, he gets up to answer it. And she says, I don't think he'd do that. And that was my greatest victory as a writer. I thought, that's wonderful. She's absolutely right. He wouldn't get up to answer the doorbell, right, because of the nature of this character. But she'd gotten so involved in the material, right, that she was sensitive to that kind of detail, which I thought was quite wonderful, actually.
Have you ever read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I have not read it, no.
There are some similar overtones. It's also science fiction, well, less science fiction. I think the Douglas Adams is the author of that, and he has taken his cue from P.G. Wodehouse.
Mm-hmm.
His character is very much like P.G. Wodehouse as he sends him into outer space, the last man in the universe. And it's very fanciful. It's not mm-hmm. unlike what you've written here. He doesn't consider his work science fiction either. Who are some of the people that you enjoy reading now?
Well, I'll be perfectly candid about it. When I'm writing, I really don't read any fiction. I just find I'm not interested in reading fiction when I'm writing, and this is true for a lot of writers, I think. I mean, I've been reading subparticle physics for 3 years now. That's really what I've been reading. And now I'm involved in writing the screenplay for the 11 Million Mile High Dancer, so that's a very different operation entirely. I was saying to the producer this morning, writing a novel is like having a farm. You can always find another few inches to plant the alfalfa. You can always add the wheat. You can buy another cow. You know, you can expand. But with a screenplay, it's like a Swiss watch. Every piece counts and it has to fit.
So who is the producer?
My producer is Iris Sawyer.
Is it an independent producer?
Yeah, she's an independent producer. And so her next job will be to sell it to a studio, which is why we're working on the screenplay now.
Well, I wish you the best.
Thank you.
You've got all the ingredients for a great movie. Will this be a full-fledged theater type
of
movie?
Feature film, mm-hmm. yeah.
How does your husband react to your work?
Well, he was very encouraging. And, you know, the old line, I could not have done this but for, it's really true. I mean, I could not have quite managed this without having a very supportive person, and my husband's great. And he's the one who said, look, what you really want to do is write, so quit your job and write this book. And now, I could support myself to some extent writing magazine articles while I was writing this book, but let's face it, you know, the financial reality pretty much is that unless you've saved up a lot of money, and I'd save some, unless you're getting some help, it's pretty hard to support yourself as a novelist. So he's been great. He was terrific. And he liked the idea, you know, and it's very hard to live with a writer because...
What does he do?
He's in the roller coaster and merry-go-round business.
No, nobody's in that kind of business.
That's what he's in.
What do you mean he's in the roller coaster and merry-go-round?
Well, you know, he owns and operates roller coasters and merry-go-rounds. which is perfectly fitting for somebody who's written a book about a world 40 million light years away.
Yeah.
We're both in the imagination business,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, he doesn't own the cyclone, does he?
Yes, he does.
Oh, yeah. What's his name?
His name is Jerry Albert.
Jerry Albert. So he owns a cyclone.
Uh-huh.
I'll be darned. Well, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
You know, you've got...
it's one of the great gravity rides in the world.
I'm sure. But, you know, you've got the perfect person and the perfect background to write a story built around merry-go-rounds and roller coasters.
Yes, I suppose that's true. It just so happens, it's characteristic of my work. I have never written from real life, as they say. I mean, I've never written anything even remotely autobiographical in the usual sense of the word. I mean, all my books are very different. I would love to have said this was autobiographical because Amanda is such a fantastic character, and all women want to be like this, I think. But I'm afraid it's not true.
Well, I want you to tell your husband for me that the cyclone may be the best ride of its kind in the world, but I'm never going to get on it. Ever. Karen Hill, thank you very much. You're certainly an engaging woman, and I thought the book was a real lark, and I know that they sent me a number of reviews. Everybody seemed to love it, and I'm delighted that you came in to spend this half hour with me, and wish you the best with it, and I hope to be able to see it in the theater at some point.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed being here.